I'm not sure, actually, I'm going to say anything that hasn't already been said this morning, but I might say it in a different order, and maybe with some different logical connectives between different bits of it. But much of what I'm going to say will be quite familiar. In fact, just by coincidence, I'm going to start by looking at the Decode Me website. Although, another page that Carl showed, I was just trying to see if it really is here. But I looked at it yesterday, and the pages that came up as a homepage were not the ones that I taken notice of. I think this is from the second level down, where if you click on complete scan, and so you're going to pay your $995 or whatever it is, and then, or you're thinking about doing that, then what does the website tell you? So the first paragraph says, explore your genetic risk factors and keep a vigilant eye on your prospects for prolonged health. Learn about your ancestry at the same time. By analysing an unparalleled 1 million genetic variants, the complete scan is the most accurate, advanced and comprehensive test of its kind. Next paragraph says, the complete scan focuses on medical conditions that can either be improved by altering your lifestyle or have better treatment options if caught early. You will receive updates to your profile as new genetic variants are discovered. So that's all, I think, consistent with what we heard from. What particularly impressed me on this is the idea that the scan is focusing on medical conditions that can either be improved by altering your lifestyle or have better treatment options if caught early. So clearly, there's a link here with preventative health. Then on the same page, there's a little box in the column. And it says, discover your genetic risk for 38 diseases and traits ranging from heart attack and diabetes to alcohol flush reaction and male pattern baldness. Now, I was quite surprised to see those two there, male pattern baldness and alcohol flush reaction. I actually not heard of alcohol flush reaction. I thought it sounded quite good, so I got a better look and see what it is. And having seen what it is, it seems to me you probably don't need a genetic test to know where you start from it. Similarly with male pattern baldness. And you know, is this going to be something that can be improved by changing lifestyle or treatment options if caught early? Well, maybe. But it's quite interesting that on the same page we go from this highly sort of responsible statement about preventative medicine to something which is more like a type of curiosity about yourself. Now, in itself, that may not raise any particular ethical issues, but it is going to be relevant to some things I'm going to come back to. So I've been asked to talk about the ethical issues. Like everyone, I don't know really what all the ethical issues are, and certainly don't know what any of the answers are. And probably like everyone in this room, I don't really know what ethical issues are anyway. So the question for us, the first question must be, what do we even mean by ethical issues here? And just to underline some of the difficulties we have with this language, at UCL we recently set up a centre to bring together the philosophy department and the medical school, and we decided that the best name for it would be the Centre for Ethics and Health. But someone at the medical school said, no, don't call it that, because it'll just make us think of filling in forms to call it the Centre for Ethics. So we really don't want the word for ethics in there. So we put the word justice in there, but that's fantastic. But you don't have to fill any forms in for justice, but you do for ethics. So there's this type of debasement of ethical language in that ethics has, to some degree, come to a type of routine behaviour whereby you're going to be checked for things. And, of course, we've already seen this morning some of the issues that will come up. So if you're thinking about a type of ethical review, what would you look at? Well, consent, retention of samples, procedures, the sorts of things that could go into a protocol. And indeed, there is a protocol. It was mentioned, I think, from 1997. We already have a little booklet on, what is it? It's still on the Department of Health website, so I'm assuming it's current. But it's like a code of practice for genetic screening. And it's got things like, make sure you keep the results confidential. It's probably got, make sure you use clean equipment, something like that. And so you can see that there are a number of procedural elements. Now, this is an important part of ethics. But I think from this from the point of view of this presentation, I think it's also important to think that ethics is not exhausted by protocols, statements, regulations. So much of what I'm going to be talking about will be things that could not easily figure into a set of protocols. Yeah. So there's a type of level of ethical reflection which isn't the same as sort of micro-regulation and management procedure. Yeah. Even though what I'm going to be saying will also bear on that. But I want to start by thinking about some issues about regulation. I know we're coming back to regulation later on, so I'm just going to talk very, very briefly about some related regulations and as a way into the ethical issues in this case. So one thing I do, you can tell from the introduction, is I sit on committees. That's how I seem to spend a lot of my life. And one committee I sat on looked at gambling law in the UK. And in relation to gambling, actually, there are an agreed set of sort of high-level principles to regulate gambling law in this country, and they've been adopted elsewhere. There are three principles for this. Fantastic. One is that the laws should be designed to keep crime out. The second is that there should be fairness to the customer, fairness to the punter, as it's called in the trade. But keep crime out, fairness to the punter, and protect the vulnerable. So those are the three principles of gambling law, and everything you do should follow from those three principles. Now that second principle, fairness to the punter, fairness to the customer, is going to be utterly generic. Right? So every area of life, we want to make sure people know what they're getting. And we had that discussion before. You know, is the website misleading? Do you know what you're getting? Do you really understand the information? Is someone trying to mislead you? Does someone have an interest in misleading you? So those issues go right the way across anything to do with a commercial transaction. So I'm not going to say very much about that. Now, in the case of gambling, you can see why the other two principles are there. Keep crime out. Well, it's a cash business, and cash attracts crime. Clearly, this is not a relevant principle in our case. Right? We're not talking about keeping crime out of genetic testing. It's not relevant. Protecting the vulnerable, again, we know people can be addicted to gambling, so and children have a problem, could have a problem, so we have principles to govern that. Why am I mentioning this? Well, because there are specific things about gambling that raise particular concerns for which you need regulation. So the question is, are there similar things in the area we're looking at now? Now what is special about direct-to-consumer, that's what we call it, isn't it? Direct-to-consumer, fill out the phrase. What's special about that that might give rise to particular reasons for regulation or broader ethical issues? I think we've already seen, actually, what I had thought of as probably the three things that give rise to some concern. So one is a question about information. So what we're doing in this case is a type of market in information. And you know, information can be used. Could it be damaging? So it may well be that there are special concerns about what we could call the ethics of information. There's also a question about power. Now, we didn't have the word power, but we did have the word gatekeeper. And we had the issue about control. So who has the right to control things? So it could be control of information, could be control of resources. So there's a whole range of questions about power and control that come up. And there's another issue that came up, actually, I was surprised, it only came up in the questions. And this is about anxiety. So, of course, it's related to information, and it's related to uncertainty, which we heard a lot about. But anxiety is going to be a major issue here for us. So it seems to me that these are the three things. There may be more things, but these are the three things we need to be thinking about when we think about a direct-to-consumer marketing. Information, power, and anxiety. Now, information, in a way, is an issue that has been debated most so far. And what are we doing? Well, people are going to a company and they're finding out information about themselves. Is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Well, in a way, we may feel we need not have that discussion. Because as was pointed out, surely people have a right to know things about themselves. Who is going to deny them that right? So that level of information, it looks like there's a type of rights argument that says that, yeah, who are you to deny me knowledge about myself? So why would you deny me? Well, that's maybe another question, but it's why would I give anyone the authority to hide things from myself? So when we think about the question of right, it seems very simple. It's very hard to counter that argument, I think. So when we're talking about the level of individual rights to knowledge, it seems to me that, you know, that is a very strong intervention. Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing to have knowledge? Well, that is quite different. Now, Julian told us that knowledge is power. He's not the first person to have that view. As a result, there are people who have a contrary view to that. So that, I mean, knowledge is power. If you have knowledge, that allows you to do things. You can do more if you know than if you don't know. As a general truth, that seems right. If you had a general choice between knowledge and ignorance, you think, well, choose knowledge, put it on your t-shirt. Choose knowledge, knowledge is power. But it doesn't mean in every case it's better for you to know things than not. So this is a great theme of 19th century Northern European drama and short stories, about whether it's actually better to know things than not. So there are innumerable plays and short stories where the question is, well, and the typical plot line is, you know, the elderly, rather bumbling man going to his grave, believing that everyone around him loves him, whereas in truth they will despise him. Is it better for him to know the truth before he dies, or to go to his grave in happy ignorance? I used to use this as an interview question for undergraduates, actually, to know, which is better. I know I told me the answer to this, but it seems to me that it's partly a matter of temperament. Some people say, of course I'd want to know. Other people say, I wouldn't want to know. It would be better for people not to tell me. So this is a great dramatic theme of these plays. Knowledge is not always a good thing. Within the philosophical tradition, read Rousseau on his discourse on the arts and sciences. Rousseau was asked, there was a prize competition set by the French Academy, has progress in arts and sciences done more to advance the interests of humankind or to put it in decline? Rousseau wrote his essay saying that the progress in arts and sciences has been very bad for us, that we would be much better without it. And he has this fantastic line that science creates dependency. In the 18th century, he was able to write, what science does is that it creates things which we didn't previously feel a need. So we have these new inventions that, you know, create some sort of need. They then create a need in us. And then when they break, or you lose them, you really miss them, even if you wouldn't have missed them without having them. So think of PowerPoint, for example. We've managed to get on fine without it. Now there are those of us who, not me, but who couldn't do without it. So you become dependent on these things. So Rousseau's idea is that technology is a sort of snare for us. We're constantly thinking that if we get this next thing, everything will be fantastic. We get it, it becomes part of the background, we forget it until it breaks. And then our life is ruined. You know, if your washing machine breaks down, how are you going to get through the next week? So it's not absolutely obvious that knowledge is always good for us. However, it doesn't follow from that we don't have a right to know. Okay, so those are separate questions. Even if we can argue that sometimes knowledge is bad for us, that doesn't establish whether we have a right to know it or not. Okay. So, just to try to broaden out the discussion, and to try to bring in some of the themes that were discussed earlier today, what I want to do is to distinguish three different levels of thinking about ethical issues. The one is the individual level. The second is what we could call the collective level. And third, the social level. And the difficulty of some of the debates we're having, I think, is that they operate at different levels. And so some of the arguments operate at the individual level, some operate at the social level, and they don't obviously engage with each other in any particularly fruitful way. Okay, so that is why I hope anyway to convince you. So the individual level is really a question of individual rights, individual harms and benefits. And so a lot of the discussion we've already had is, you know, can people use the information properly if they've been given it? How should it affect their life? So I get a test that tells me my risk of developing diabetes is 50% higher than the norm. Well, if I'm an American, according to the American Diabetes Association, my risk already is 8%. If I'm an American, my risk of developing diabetes is 8%. I now find it's 12%. How am I meant to respond to that? What am I meant to do? So that is a very significant increase in my risk. Is there a rational answer to that question? It's a matter of temperament. So there are these questions at individual level. What can people do with this information? Now, what will they do with the information? Well, they'll probably go to their doctor. So this was mentioned early on. And in fact, at the Nuffield Council, when we had a discussion, I think, were you there? I can't remember. You were the representative, so you were there. And you know, you made similar arguments, which I think are very strong and powerful. And the representative of the NHS were saying, but you're going to be putting the costs on us, because you're going to be scaring people, and they're going to come to us. And, well, and what, right? Now, we're still operating at an individual level here. The sort of the tragedy of all of this is diagnosis. I mean, the tragedy of medical science is the mismatch between diagnosis and therapy. That we have fantastic diagnostic tools. What we can actually do is very limited. And if you take the skeptical view, you know, the view that was very popular in the 70s and 80s and still hasn't gone away, I think, you know, what can your GP do for you? Well, if you've got an infection, your GP can give you antibiotics. If you've got a broken arm or some sort of surgical condition, the GP can send you off to hospital. Otherwise, what are they going to do? They might give you a painkiller, or, there was one historian of medicine talking about pre-modern medicine, but I think it's still... They're going to tell you, put something hot on it, put something cold on it, take some exercise, or take some rest. Which is roughly the theory of the four humours. And in most consultations with most GPs go like that. And unless they give you a pink pill, okay, and you don't know what's in that pill. So, is this completely useless? No, it isn't. Because what doctors are doing is managing your anxieties. So you go to a doctor worried about something, and the doctor tells you to stop worrying. It's perfectly normal for a man of your age, right? So don't... it's not a concern, right? The trouble is, they don't yet have a repertoire of responses to calm people down when they've been told their risk of diabetes is 50% higher than the average. What are they going to do? I mean, maybe they do. Maybe diabetes is a bad example, because this is something that maybe GPs will deal with quite often. But for a lot of these other conditions, you're told you've got a 10% higher chance. The doctor doesn't know what to do. So the doctor is confronted with a patient whose anxieties they can't manage. Yeah. And this is very threatening to the medical profession, because it's sort of disempowering for doctors to be confronted with this. So this is still at an individual level. But I think this is one of the reasons why the medical profession is rather frightened about this. Because it's taking power away from them, because they cannot control people's anxieties in the way in which they use to do. Now, maybe none of this rings true for you. This is, you know, purely speculation. I have done no study to support this, but it's just a thought about what could be happening, a thought about part of the dynamics. So we've got, at the individual level, we have people who appear to have a right to know things about themselves. They're not going to be very good at managing that information. They're going to ask for help, and they can't really be given help. And this is a worrying set of circumstances. So this is one of the reasons why we have an ethical concern here. Is it a reason for regulation? Well, I don't know. It may be, but I want to resist the inference from something being, we could say, regressible, a situation being regressible to it needing regulation or regulation even being appropriate. I think this is a very difficult discussion to have because we tend to think if you show something that is questionable, well, what should we do about it? What law should we pass? What regulation should we pass? But maybe there's no regulation we can pass about it. Now, I'll come back to that in a moment. Or the regulation might be counterproductive. Okay, so at an individual level, we have this situation which I think is hard for everyone to manage. New knowledge comes in, we just don't know what to do with it. The system isn't up and running to deal with it. This creates a number of problems we've seen. The collective level is one where we can think about long-term effects or effects of lots of people doing the same sorts of things. So at the moment, if we've only got a few people taking these tests and going to the GPs, so when these GPs presented to the National Council, one of them said, there are all these people getting the private tests and they're coming to the GPs. I said, that's very interesting. Have you had any patients like that? So, well, no. But it's happening. It's happening. Right? And actually, I don't know if it is happening. It could happen. Maybe studies have been done now. If it's only on a small scale, there's no collective problem. But if it became large scale, then it would be a problem because it would be diverting resources away from other things. And then the NHS would have to come to some view about it. But it's not going to be a terribly difficult problem. They're going to have to decide whether to offer post-genetic screening consultations on the NHS or privatise it, or something along those lines. So it will be irritating, but it's not the end of the world for them. So the collective level, I think, is a type of technical problem, but not a huge problem. The individual level, I've already talked about. The third thing I want to do is talk about the social level. And this is much more complicated, much harder to know what to deal with. Now, in thinking about this, I found it quite helpful to think about some things that Michael Sandel said in the first Reith lecture. I was lucky enough to go to his lecture on Monday in London. I believe he's giving his second one in Oxford tonight. But Michael Sandel argued that we need to think about the social meanings of goods. And I've heard this before, and I haven't really taken much notice of it, but he made a very good case. Now, he wasn't talking about genetic interventions. He was talking about the market society. And he argued, as many people have argued, that we have too much commodification, or at least we have moved into a commodified world. The way he puts it is that we used to have a market economy, now we've got a market society. That is, we run everything within society on the same lines, and this is happening to education, it's happening to health, it appears to be happening to genetics. This is changing the social meaning of things, he says. Now, this is a very vague thing to say, and it's sort of almost embarrassing for some people to talk about social meanings of goods. But it's something we're used to, even if we don't see it in these terms. So just as when I was looking at the Decode Me website, I happened to see on the BBC website, I think this was yesterday or the day before, I didn't really take it in at the time, a doctor was arguing in favour of more caesarean sections. I don't know where this was from, I don't know if it's probably no one in this room, I doubt. But in any case, this person was saying, studies have shown that outcomes are much better if you're very generous with C-sections. If you do lots of C-sections, then more babies survive. I suppose that's right. And so the obstacle for this is that these women have this terrible, old-fashioned, mystical view of childbirth as something you do at home or just with a midwife. It's meant to be a meaningful experience for them. They don't understand they're killing their babies by selfishly insisting on this meaningful experience. Well, you may have that view. You may not have that view. But the point is that I would say there are two different understandings of the social meaning of childbirth here. One is childbirth is a way of bringing an infant into the world, and that's it. And another is that childbirth is a very meaningful part of a woman's experience, maybe for the immediate family as well. And that there's a whole other set of significance that goes along with that. Very hard to argue for this. But it's there as a view. Now, from this point of view, I'm not trying to say one is right, one is wrong, but I'm saying that these things do have a social meaning. And critics of modern medicine have claimed too much of life has become medicalized. So pregnancy has become treated as if it's an illness. It's become a medical condition. You know, people who believe in the social model of disability, it's the same thing about disability. Disability has been medicalized. It used to be something that was managed within a family, it was understood as part, ordinary part of life. Now it's a medical condition, and the doctors have got their hands on it. And we've got to get it back. So these things have a social meaning, and these social meanings can be contested. There are many examples of this, where our conception of something changes. So it's been argued that since the 18th century, our conception of nature has changed. That with, you know, Galileo and Descartes and the new mathematics, nature has been arithmeticized, mathematicized, I suppose. I don't quite know what the term is. But to this point where, and you know, this is part of the scientific worldview, essentially things are only real if you can measure them. If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. And for an economist, if you can't pay for it, it doesn't exist. And for a consequentialist philosopher, again, if you can't count it and weigh it against other things, it doesn't exist either. So all these things are changing our conception of nature, of reality, of value. And so we have, at another level, a discussion about what the social meaning of something. It might be the social meaning of health. So is health a commodity, or information about health a commodity that should be bought and sold on the market like any other commodity? Is that a good way of understanding health? Or should we think of health in some other way? What would it be? Well, health is something that is the preserve of a profession. That only certain profession members of profession should have the right to tell people what they can know about their own health, or the right to oversee health. I mean, in a way, neither of these are particularly compelling social meanings of health. And the over-professionalization seems, yeah, from my point of view, not a particularly good way of thinking about health. Commodification doesn't seem to be a particularly good way of thinking about it. There should be some other way. Maybe there is. But what I want to say is we can have that debate about what type of understanding of health do we want to have in our society. And we can think that we're moving in a direction that we should celebrate. You know, because if you believe in democratization, if you believe in commodification, individualization, then we're moving in the right direction by having these direct-to-consumer forms of marketing. You think this is a good thing, we should celebrate it. Other people might say it's a bad thing, we should regress it. Doesn't follow from that we should regulate in any particular way. Partly because you can't really regulate directly a social meaning. You can't have a set of regulations that says we should think about it one way rather than another. Although, of course, you could have regulations that encourage some social meaning. So in the case of pregnancy, laws about permissible home birth, for example, laws about who is allowed to attend a pregnancy, could affect the social meaning of it. But you can't regulate that people should directly think about it one way rather than another. So the point I just wanted to get across is that there's a type of discourse where the commercialization, individualization is almost irresistible. We say, well, I've got a right to know. Who's going to stop me? Who has a right to stop me? And we can say, yes, once this gets going, really, it's very hard to say someone's got a right to stop me. It sounds incredibly paternalistic. Unless you can show that there's some real danger from people knowing this. Danger to third parties, say. If you knew this, then it would cause some big problem elsewhere. No one has shown that. No one has shown that, you know, people know about the risk factors is going to cause deaths on the road or something to third parties. We haven't seen that. So that argument looks irresistible. But we can still say, is it something we want to encourage or discourage? Is it something, if we're writing a letter to the editor, what sort of letter should we write? Now, if we're talking to our students about it, should we think this is a cause for celebration or a cause for regret? And people can differ on this view. So I think that on one level, so I think this is the last thing I want to say, on one level the argument, you know, I have a right to information myself, is decisive in the sense it's very hard to see what one could
use the stop button. But that doesn't mean that we should think it's a good thing that lots of people want to have this information. It may be a good thing, it may be a bad thing, but my only point really, and it's taken a long time to get to my only point really is that it doesn't follow from the fact that people have a right that it is a good thing that people are doing this, and it doesn't follow that we have to approve of it in our conversations with other people or in these rooms. It doesn't follow that we don't have to either, so you could think it's a good thing as well. But I think there's still that debate to be had about whether this is the sort of thing we want to have in society or not. Now, you know, some people might think, well, how can we live in a liberal society, how can we legislate on these grand values, because they're not shared values? But in a sense, we don't have any choice, because anything will have a social meaning, and these social meanings are contested, and we need to discuss them. We need to discuss what we want to encourage or discourage. Okay, so that's all I want to say.
Okay, thank you.